Today is Monday, January 30th, 2023. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Donald spells his last name D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you doing today?
Hunkering down in my wood-burning house here, trying to stay warm. It's gone above zero, but not that far.
Oh my gosh. Well, I hope you've got ample supply of wood there to keep.
I don't actually.
Oh dear.
I'm running awfully low on it.
Oh my.
I'll get through this winter. I'm not sure about another season.
Okay. Well, at least this winter you'll get through. That's okay. In part 5, we talked about some pretty amazing caving that you did in Grand Canyon with ropes off of the red wall. And before we move on into the 1970s, are there any other cave adventures in the 1960s that you wanted to bring to this interview?
Well, I think we've already talked about Paiute Cave.
Yes.
But there was another... a really interesting thing that happened, I think it was in the mid or late 60s. I'd need to check my records to be positive. But at some point, I went down from the House Rock Valley to look at Stanton's Cave, the large opening that the river trippers see as they're going by Vasey's Paradise, and which got the name from Robert Brewster Stanton's river trip past there, as far as I'm aware. And I went into the cave and went to the far back end. It was upsloping all the way. And at that time, there was a long homemade ladder that was leaning up from the end of the main level into an opening above, and I climbed that ladder to see what might be up there. I found out that it only ended in a small chamber. You couldn't even stand inside it. You needed to stay on the ladder, if I remember correctly. And I noticed that on a little prong of rock on one side and on the left, there was a blob, so to speak, of stone, a laminated siltstone, different from the red wall limestone composing the cave wall, and it had some loose fragments on top. I idly turned one over and looked at the bottom of the quarter-inch thick slab, and I saw 4 footprints in it. A tiny little trackway of some animal that was fossilized.
Hmm.
You could clearly see the claw marks, at least 4 of them, and maybe 5 and 1 or 2 of those. And it had made about 4 tracks across a zone maybe 1.25 inches wide and gone off the broken rock. But this had to be really old, because to be that consolidated, it was most likely from the origin of Stanton's Cave, which I concluded was probably a Paleozoic paleocave that formed not long after the red wall limestone had solidified.
Okay.
And had been filled up with fine silt, perhaps from surface streams flowing on the flat terrain at that time.
Hmm.
And probably the whole cave was paleo, but only this fragment of the fill remained above the ground, so to speak. There may be more of it underneath the floor of the cave, too. But this was such a surprising discovery that I collected the positive impression, leaving the actual imprints in place, and I gave it to the Museum of Northern Arizona, and they published it actually as, or under the title, Arizona's Oldest Amphibian.
Huh.
They'd consulted with trackway experts and determined to their satisfaction that this was actually an amphibian trail recorded in that. And I've been to Stanton's Cave another time after that. The ladder now is gone, and most likely the actual trackway is still in place in the cave. I hope so.
Okay. Wow. That's amazing. So you're thinking that when the cave was young, some sort of amphibian creature would have had access and sort of pulled up maybe on the sand there or walked across the sand?
It could have been, indeed,
okay.
Yes. Or was swimming around in there.
Huh, yeah. And popped up kind of in this chamber? And
yeah, and maybe just happened to come into it when that silt was accumulating.
Oh, that's amazing.
And did walk across who knows how far, because only this remnant bit of it remained.
It was just recently I saw a photo of someone going up that ladder. It was an older photo. So, when was the second time you were back in there? Do you remember?
I'm not sure. It could have been on my only river trip there in 1981. We very likely made a stop there and looked
okay.
around.
All right. Okay. Huh. Any other thing you
actually,
remember about that Stanton's Cave?
I think I probably misled you with that remark. But I was there at a different time when we explored Falls Cave.
Hmm.
And that's another one that I had better talk about because it's a relatively major cave and for a long time, in fact, was the longest surveyed cave, I think, in Arizona.
Hmm.
But by Falls Cave, I mean that just upriver from the Stanton's Cave, the big conspicuous cave mouth, there's a spring that gushes the Vasey's Paradise waterfall that all the river trips see, and many of them stop and
mm-hmm.
look around. And it happens that by climbing up the almost vertical cliff next to the waterfall, cavers have been able to get into that system. The water does come out midway between the entrance of the cave proper and the bottom of the cliff there, because it has pirated a route from the open cave down a crevice to the cliff. So only when there's very high water in the cave do you see water coming out from the main entrance level.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
Forming the waterfall.
Okay.
But if you get up into there, which we did in 1969, and this wasn't actually the first caving visit. There had been at least one earlier, and it was a pretty serious trip for me. I'd only been caving for 12 years at that point. There were half a dozen of us, mostly from Arizona, and I had come out, I think, from California or Colorado, whichever one I happened to be in at the time. And we set about to do a long trip in there, seeing if we could explore to any kind of ending. There was strong wind in the cave, showing that it had to be quite extensive, and probably miles in length and possibly extending all the way back maybe 15 miles to the flank of the Kaibab uplift.
Hmm.
So we thought that very promising. And at that time, the water was running in the entrance passage, almost to the entrance, and the way to get in was for one, the best climber in the team, to climb up to the mouth and anchor a rope, and then the less good climbers were to ascend the rope into the main entrance up there. And so we all did that, and we're walking along through the cave, and at one point the stream sumped, and the passage continued by a scramble up a chimney, and then horizontally again in air-filled passage for a short distance, and up there was a place that got named Gypsum Grass Alley, because gypsum growths that looked a lot like blades of grass swirled up from the dirt floor. It had been dry, but not totally dry, for a long time, and evaporation had been drying gypsum into these beautiful swirling grass formations, so it got named Gypsum Grass Alley. Unfortunately, there was no way to continue except to step on some of the gypsum grass.
Oh my.
So the previous trip had made single footsteps at suitable intervals, and we followed the same marks through to try to do as little additional damage as possible. And beyond that, you get back to the stream passage, which has some travertine deposited, I think, along it as you see outside where the water comes out. And a long distance in, then the cave breaks into a maze pattern where the river again goes underground and out of sight, and the other passages are somewhat smaller in dimensions, but one must negotiate through that. And then come to a deep green lake in a chamber where there are calcite rafts floating on the water surface.
Wait, can you explain that?
In highly calcite-saturated cave water, which is calm enough, evaporation and loss of carbon dioxide from the pool water can cause calcite to begin precipitating at the interface between the water and the atmosphere. And it will do this in the form of very thin rafts, less than a millimeter thick initially. They're lightweight enough that the surface tension at the margins will hold them up and keep them from sinking spontaneously.
That's amazing. Had you seen that before
yes,
you encountered
actually,
it there?
It's not an extremely rare thing, especially in caves that are developed from underflow, as we call that. Words again are getting away from my brain, but in any case, it's common when caves that have been flooded with water have the water table receding and leaving air, replacing it in the cave, and that's when you get the strongest evaporation. And in, say, Lechuguilla Cave in New Mexico, so many generations of rafts has formed that you've actually walked in what look like dunes of calcite raft that can be 5 or 6 feet deep or more, all accumulated a raft at a time as they grew on the surface slowly, and eventually either some tremor of the water would make them sink, or they would get too big and sink of their own weight.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Or in some cases from water dripping from the ceiling from, say, stalactites, just hitting the rafts will make them sink. Huh. And the result of that is that they will flow in to fill the empty void just from statistical distribution.
Hmm.
And they then get sunk in their turn by a drift from that same place.
Hmm.
And in Lachigia, things have been piled up in some chambers that are 10 or 12 feet high that are calcite glued piles of calcite rafts that look like stalagmites that are not normal stalagmites, but rather formed at the water's surface and just below that when they sunk to the bottom.
Mm. This must require just the right type of, you know, a large volume of air flowing by to be dry enough to evaporate the water, and the water needs to be super still. So there's just so many things that would be required there to make that happen. That's amazing. And of course you have to have enough calcium in the water, which would make sense in the limestone because it's calcium carbonate. So you'd have a lot of calcite there.
And in this case, they were still floating in Falls Cave and made a beautiful photograph down into the green water. But we had worked our way around the pool, which apparently was an upwelling point from the hidden stream below, and got into what got named the subway passage that was maybe 2,000 feet in length.
Wow.
And averaged maybe 30 feet high by 20 feet wide.
Wow.
Going horizontally, perfectly well along that level. Occasionally there were odd-looking stalactites at the top that are shaped a lot like sugar beets, and blotty at the top and short. And this may have something to do with atmospheric phenomena, too. I'm not really clear about that, but similar things have been seen in Nevada caves and puzzled the cave scientists there. So we eventually suddenly came to a point where the horizontality ended and the passage abruptly went steeply down a sandy slope to a depth of maybe 50 feet below the original level, and it began to turn underneath through a crawly hole, and I heard roaring noise through there that sounded like a waterfall beyond that point somewhere. So I took off my hard hat and I began to dig with my hard hat, an aluminum hard hat at the time, and we all took turns with digging through that thing, and it took us perhaps 4 hours, but we eventually, there was also a strong wind coming through, and when we got the hole bigger, the roaring noise stopped.
Oh, wow.
And it turned out that we hadn't been hearing a waterfall. That was an auditory illusion. It was simply the wind was so strong through there, it made a roaring noise.
Wow.
So it opened up again, went back up the 50 feet, and went another 500 or 600 feet at the subway passage level, and then came to a massive collapse of limestone from above, where you could see that water had welled out at the base in the rubble there with sand deposited around where it issued from. But at the top of that, we were not able to find a way on. So it was my custom at that time in the Grand Canyon, when I did something I thought was especially notable and wanted to mark the point, I would try to have in my pocket a penny of the year that I was doing this.
Oh my gosh.
And I'd leave the pennies at points like that. I did some on the surface in some of my trips, and then a couple or three in caves. So this was all taking quite a while, and we'd been getting wet in the stream. Fortunately, it was 64 degrees.
Ooh.
Rather than being bitter cold as the waters in many western caves are. And we were wearing just coveralls, usually of the kind that cavers did wear at the time, cotton, and because we'd gotten so wet wading in the entry zone, we had been caving for the subsequent hours, partly to try to dry ourselves off and be less cold. And so when we got back to the point of the maze zone, we'd been in the cave many hours, and we'd been anticipating having to do a bivouac in there, which we did. We found a nice sandy floored crouchway passage, and all six of us laid down along the extent of this passage in a row, side to side. It was wide enough to do that. And we had one wool blanket for every three cavers, so of necessity we were crowding in there pretty closely. And I remember that as I let my carbide lamp run out of water, and it took some time, but I was lying there gazing at the ceiling just 4 feet above me, dimly showing in the fading light, and thinking, we are under half a mile of solid rock.
Yeah.
We were clear back under the rim on the surface at that point, and it blew my mind to try to really imagine that. It was almost impossible. But we got through the night, and then finally left the cave after 46 hours of being in the cave.
Wow.
And we had by no means seen all the possible places in there for
my gosh
to continue.
Huh.
That was the longest time I'd spent in a cave continuously, and for quite a while, until I did a little longer such trip in Mexico at one point, and then it became routine in Lechuguilla Cave.
Okay.
This much more modern caver, Jason Belensky, has been not only discovering vastly longer caves farther west in the Red Wall, but he's also undertaken to re-explore and resurvey Falls Cave. The cave has been unusually friendly in recent years.
Yes, with low water.
Drier, yeah. And he has gotten the cave up to more than, I think, 7 miles of survey. And at one point, he was going to the back of the main passage there, and he found my penny.
Oh, my gosh.
He found what I'd left there 40 years or so ago, and that made me really glad that I'd left that little token, because it told me exactly where in the cave we had been and he had been at the same point.
Right.
And just 2 feet away from that, he found something that led him to start digging.
Wow.
And he managed to break through fairly easily, just with hand digging there in the continuing cave. But that went another several hundred feet, I think, and it again got blocked, I think, by a sump at that point. So his explorations haven't gotten all that much farther into the main conduit, but he thinks that if it stays dry, I just heard from him a couple of days ago.
Okay.
They may be able to, if that sump goes away, then they may be able to proceed further.
Right.
So Falls Cave has been quite an adventure in itself and over a quite lengthy period.
Yeah, we're getting enough moisture this winter that I bet it's going to come back. We've just had a series, consecutive series of very dry winters, but that's, I don't know, might. Well, wish him luck, huh, to get through there.
I do. He's a stronger caver than I ever was, I believe.
Huh. And is that B-O-L-I-N-S-K-I?
It's B-A-L-L-E-N-S-K-Y.
Thank you.
Belinsky.
Okay. And do you...
In San Diego, I believe.
Okay. Do you know why the name was called Fall Cave, Falls Cave?
And because it fed the waterfall at the...
Oh, okay.
Actually, a very prosaic reason.
Yeah, how about that? Huh. I think it would be called Vasey's Cave or something. Huh. I think it'd be called Vasey's Cave or Paradise Cave or something, but Falls Cave, okay.
Vasey is, of course, had been kind of preempted, but, well, anyway. The,
yeah, yeah.
I guess I needn't say more about Falls Cave for the time being.
Okay. Well, that's... I had heard that that had been explored for a long ways, but that's all I knew, so thank you for filling in that, and it's been decades that I'd heard that, so I appreciate your filling me in on what was in there.
The most unusual thing about it is that it is in the upper Red Wall limestone and still running active water, although a great majority of the caves in the Grand Canyon are in the Red Wall. The only other couple that are still flowing, one is, I'm trying to think of a name again and having trouble. Anyway, it's a cave off the North Rim that comes out rather high in the Red Wall. And was explored in the early 1900s by the Cole brothers.
Oh, that would be Chiava? Chiava Falls?
Chiava Falls, that's what I was trying to think of. And then what else is there in the Red Wall that's running water? I think there's a third one, but it's not coming to mind. And there are several major caves off the North Rim. But other than this recent cluster of giant abandoned caves high up in the Shunimu Amphitheater, they are all low in the Muab Limestone, Thunder Petite Cave, Roaring Springs Cave, which has been the water source for the Grand Canyon park things for decades.
Did you get into Roaring Springs?
I did, yes.
Can you tell me about it?
I believe that is another thing I did in 65 that I'd forgotten to mention. And yeah, that was another trip with some of the Arizona cavers from Phoenix. And the cave has half a dozen openings, entrances, so there's no problem finding a way into it. And inside a few hundred feet, that all unites into two passages. One which has a stream in it, and the other to the east is dry, at least at normal water level.
Okay.
So the cave had not been surveyed at that point, so we did so and got a respectable map. I don't remember what the mileage came to, but the cave was at least a half mile back to the interior, where I can't recall how it ended without referring to what I might have recorded about it, but eventually it came to something, probably a terminal breakdown, that didn't allow us to keep exploring, and the dry passage did something similar and ended without easy continuation.
Okay. And was that under the auspices of the Park Service?
Yes, we had permission for it.
Okay. Do you know who you contacted at the time to get permission?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I may not have been the one who did it even.
Okay. And then the map would have gone to the Park Service for...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, when we survey things in national parks, the routine is that we provide them with the raw data on the cave as well as with finished map productions.
And cool.
Thereby, both parties benefit.
And did you get into Chiava as well?
I know. Actually, I tried to do that much later when it was surveyed by some cavers from Durango.
Hmm.
That was one of the last things I did. I think it was clear up in the late 90s or early zeros. And I found that I could no longer make it with the load of food and water that was needed for that. I made it down to the top of the Coconino and then realized that I'm not in shape for this any longer.
Mm.
So I've got to go back and wait for you guys at the truck, which I did. I split from the team and climbed back onto the rim. And then the first big snowstorm of the season hit, and I ended up being trapped in the truck basically for the remaining 3 days.
Wow.
Which had never happened to me when I was doing things in the earlier time in the canyon. It was rather a boring time there.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up with around, I think, 9 inches of snow. And the park, in fact, sent a plow in after us. Otherwise, we'd have been wintering the entire season then, because we were the last trip out to that part of the rim in that winter.
Hmm. Okay.
But we escaped, and the cavers made an excellent map for the park.
Great.
Falls Cave sumps about 600 feet back, which was too bad. We know it has to come from a long way off.
Yeah. 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 Okay. And then, of course, I'm telling you, you talked about Tepetz Creek Cave.
Yes.
And you talked about Deer Spring Cave.
Yes.
Was there.
And Pete Huntoon, whom I've mentioned, has written about what he thinks the hydrology of these caves is, and it's his opinion that Deer Creek, both of the Deer Creek Springs, as well as Thunder River and Tepetz Cave, are all tapping the same body of groundwater because the analysis, the chemical analysis of the waters is uniquely similar among these.
Oh, caves. That would make sense. Huh.
Yeah, he thinks that there's a downfall back of the caves somewhere, and that this has allowed water to accumulate without leaking out, except at the edges of the water body.
Hmm.
So apparently these caves are all tapping this massive amount of groundwater that's accumulated under the back of the north rim there.
Right, right. And it's interesting at a fall cave, Vasey's Paradise there, if you go downstream, you go around the corner past Red Wall Cavern, and then there's a little straightaway, and the river hangs a left, a little light, slight left, and then slight right, and has another straightaway that goes down past Nautiloid Canyon. And just as you enter that straightaway that goes down past Nautiloid, on the right, there's a series of springs that are, oh gosh, sort of at river level, 10 feet above the vegetation there in the first set of springs. And the second spring is in a travertine cone. It has a hole in it. And you can
I never saw those things.
Put your cup in the hole and fill it up with the water that's thundering down there, coming out of a, oh, I'm sure it's a, maybe a foot diameter hole that has a good amount of water coming out of it. I always thought, I wonder if that's connected over to what would be Falls Cave system somehow. Again, Hantoon, you'd have to do a water signature to see if that was the same.
Did it taste mineralized at all?
No.
I know there are things on the opposite side of the river from that known as the Fence Springs, which, along with Blue Springs farther upriver, are apparently draining portions of the aquifer to the east and even south of the canyon.
Right, and the Fence Fall Complex, of course, is upstream of Vases. Oh, I want to say a half mile, maybe a mile. The Fence Fault crosses up further north of Vases, and the Nautiloid Canyon are further south there. But there's water coming out, bubbling up out of the ground on both sides of the river there at Fence Fault. And again, there would be another possible cave system there if you could get into it. But the water volume, somebody mentioned when Marston and others did their low water 1963 traverse, they found quite a large volume of water discharging into the river at Fence Fault, which you don't see when the water in the main Colorado River is higher.
Well, Marston would have been before they dammed the river.
That was just after the river was dammed, was 63, and they had taken reclamation to taking control of the river, and the flow was very low, 1,000, 1,500 CFS. So in that low water, they were in little sport yaks, and that's when they saw this large amount of water coming up out of that fault system up there. But yeah, so that would be interesting to get a signature of that one as well, and then you could see where that water is coming from. Curious.
Blue springs are certainly coming from something very big and remote because the water is quite saline.
Right, very different. Very different. Of course, Vases is potable, though I think there's some amount of giardia in it that I think that report says if you drink 50 gallons of it, you'll get giardia, but by then you'll be long since dead because you've drunken too much water.
I wonder how giardia would even be in it. That's so far on the flank of the plateau to the west of there. There's another cave in the red wall where it's already tilted, named Wildcat Cave, and we found it, or didn't find it actually, someone else had earlier, but found that in the 60s and tried digging it out. You have to root 30 or 40 feet into it, football-shaped chamber, and at the bottom there was a blast of air from a crawlway, similar to what had been in the back of Falls, and it was so strong that when I was digging in there, I had to have someone hold a coat over the hole behind me to slow down the wind, or there was so much in my eyes that I couldn't work there.
Huh.
But when we got finished digging there, it had started to go up, but it wound up right into a blockage of leached limestone boulders that we were afraid to pull on because they would fall directly on us. And
oops.
So we didn't get to see what the cave did. Ultimately, someone, I don't know who, did dig out Wildcat Cave and found a fairly major cave back there that is well decorated. But I wondered myself whether the wind in Wildcat Cave is somehow related to that in Falls Cave, 10 or 15 miles away from it.
I guess for Falls Cave, the thought is that the water moves from the surface through the cave to the Vaishya's Paradise waterfall.
Yes.
Fairly quickly. Doesn't spend a lot of time.
Yes, it need to, at least while you see it, it's moving right along.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting thinking about that. In that same area, and we might as well take this tangent since we're talking about that area, because we've gone down the river now and around a couple corners to Nautiloid Canyon, and just below Nautiloid, but not down to the Bridge of Sai, there is a cave up in the red wall that Steve Emsley and Jim Mead got into, if I think I have that location correctly, looking for Pleistocene condor remnants.
I had seen one entrance up there on my river trip and noted it on my map.
Okay.
And it turned out to be the only one that I had recorded on the river trip that I had the opportunity to go to on the ground, and that was a year or two later, and I got invited on the Emsley trip, which went in there by helicopter. I think that was in 1993, and which turned out, in fact, to be one of my very last major canyon activities before I got too old to handle it. But
should we talk about that now, or should we talk about some more of the 1970s?
It depends on how you want to organize the sequence.
Oh, that's a good idea. Let me look at the time here and see what that is. Well, we've got a good 20 minutes to go. You know what? Let's. I don't want to miss that. But let's save that for last, because I think you went in by helicopter. Most likely, you went up to Stevens Cave as well, and some of the other Little Nankoweap caves. So.
Stevens, the one I had marked.
Okay. So let's hold that off for now.
Yes, and I did have quite a major adventure there too.
Okay.
Couldn't wait.
I'll look forward to hearing that. So we're does that pretty much exhaust out the 60s for you, with Falls Cave and Chava Falls?
Well, not necessarily, but again, my memory is just so chopped up in that period that
okay.
I can easily forget something or mislocate it in date. I'm just fortunate that I did keep a good record in my correspondence, so there's something to check against what I say.
Nice. Okay. And I'll look forward to getting into that and connecting those dots up as well. What other caves out in the 1970s? Did you then leave Grand Canyon and head into other cave areas?
Actually, I should go back a little. Had we talked about the Lava Canyon Top Cave?
We did.
Okay,
yes, and you were with Doc Ellis on that.
Yes.
Yep.
That was already started.
Right. And so that and Paiute Cave were the two caves where you found indigenous containers or pots.
There are two others, actually.
Okay.
One of them was on the flank of Osiris Temple on the west side. And I went in a couple of hundred feet, and there was one pot in there, a gray corrugated pot, and associated with a few tiny corn cobs.
Ah, okay.
And then still farther west, when we had the opportunity to do some things on the Wallapai Indian Reservation, I found a cave with a pot. caught in it.
Okay. Have we talked about your explorations there at Marowitica and Spencer Canyon?
I know, and let's see, I think those might be back in 65, I think.
Oh, so let's stick with the 60s a little bit more. Let's see. How did you know that Spencer or Marowitica might be a place you might want to go?
Because I knew there were springs in those canyons, in limestone. And springs in limestone is a major trigger for a deer hunter.
Yeah.
So I wanted to take good looks at all those places. And I had my old green Chevrolet pickup truck, 1954 pickup truck, I believe, at that time. Unless I had just then gotten my later panel truck, I forget now. But I was able to drive out on that plateau, and Quartermaster Canyon, how did I get in there? I don't remember the route, strangely. But there was a way to get below the Red Wall. But that's farther west. I should start with
right.
Spencer.
You know, because you're talking about Quartermaster, there is a large spring there.
Yes.
And when there's enough water coming out of that spring, it ends up backing up and discharging through another vent hole that runs along and across the top of a flat top travertine dome and then cascades down the side of that dome into the Colorado River upstream of the actual mouth of Quartermaster Canyon.
Very far upstream?
No. A quarter mile, just up around the bend with Burnt Canyon coming in on the right, so it's just upstream of Burnt Canyon. And then just downstream of Burnt on the left is Quartermaster.
I hadn't seen the variation in the water there.
And I only heard about that from a friend of mine who was a river patrol ranger for Meadview and would come up in a patrol boat every day up into the lower end of Grand Canyon there when the reservoir had backed up that far back in the day and do patrols there. And he called me and said, you can't believe what's going on. Well, of course, it had been very wet. It was a wet, wet year when he called and said, the water's just cascading over the top of the travertine dome. And you walk up there and there was a spring that sort of welled up. And then there was a notch. There's a notch cut in the top of the travertine dome, and almost like an irrigation canal. The water runs along, goes across the top of the dome, and then spills down the side, down to the river. Fascinating. So did you get down into Quartermaster?
Yes.
And did you find a way, did you find any caves there to
explore? I know,
explore?
Well, it's possible I was looking too low. I should have gone higher, probably. There was a sort of a hint of something up there, but I don't know.
Okay. There's definitely, you know, water there coming up, but it's almost like at the Pete's level, it's where it's coming out of the ground there. It's way down. It's not down in the, it's not up in the Red Wall. So you want to go back and check up there. Huh, fascinating.
Yes, the volumes of travertine in these canyons are really astounding. Quartermaster could have a significant fraction of a cubic mile, I think, of travertine accumulated.
Oh, wow.
But in some ways even more impressive is Marowitica.
Okay.
Which has a travertine dam that's literally half a mile across and 400 feet thick. Actually dimensions like a fairly standard man-made reservoir-type dam.
Hmm.
Totally natural, built up by all the travertine deposit. And at present, the travertine or rather the stream, which is only about 4 feet across, issues from near the base of the slope on the east side of the canyon, without, again, my being able to find an open cave, which is not surprising because the entrance would have been backed up by the travertine accumulation, and probably the cave is completely full of water now. But anyway, the interesting thing about that spring, or one of them, is that the dam had backed up about 5 or 6 miles of earth that had not been able to incise into the canyon bed because the dam was backing it up.
Right.
And the Indians had found this canyon early on, and there's a big cliff dwelling in the west wall of Merowetica Canyon, literally by far the largest structure I've seen in the Grand Canyon overhangs. And when I went over to look at that, I found that there were still a lot of corn cobs on the slope below the overhang that were up to 9 inches long.
Wow.
Considerably bigger corn than I'd seen with cobs elsewhere, or I've seen these things around the Southwest.
Yeah, huh.
And then there were calcified ditches in the shallow soil above the dam. And however, since that was inhabited also by early white men, briefly at least, I don't know for sure whether those original irrigation works were Indian or white, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were Indian simply because of the size of the dwelling directly above there.
Right.
And then the stream itself, then, you could bathe in there. It was tepid, almost water, and little fishes live in it, about an inch and a half long fish.
Huh.
And I have always wondered, are these things introduced somehow, or is this a native population of some fish like the ones at Devil's Hole, Nevada, maybe has never even been named scientifically, and I've never known who to actually try to get interested in finding out about them.
Right.
They would nibble at you.
Huh.
Rather pleasantly, really.
Uh-huh. Kind of tickling. Yeah.
And then around the corner, if you go around on the slope from Merowetica, you come into Spencer Canyon, that's quite near it, and that too has big springs that they're coming down from the western side of the point that they're on quite an elevated slope, so there's a series of travertine terraces there that extends for a few hundred feet down the slope rather than damming the major creek in the way it did in Merowetica. Also in Merowetica, when I went down there, I remember seeing a Hereford bull.
Oh, my.
They apparently had run cattle at some point in there, and one of them presumably escaped, and there he was, living a life of royally in Merowetica Canyon.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, back to Spencer. Spencer has a large travertine cave in it. By large, I mean 200 feet or so long.
Wow.
Which, for a cave of that kind, a constructional travertine cave that's literally been roofed over by the travertine, is a sizable cave. And it had a nursery colony of Townsend's bats.
Okay.
There were several hundred bats, and they had baby bats with them.
Huh.
This is known to the bat community. I think, I don't know whether it was my own report that got the knowledge of it out, or more likely other people who have been down there reported them, but the Bat people did know about the Travertine Cave in Spencer Canyon.
Okay.
This kind of bat likes very warm caves for a nursery site, and up to 80 degrees or more. Whereas they winter typically in the coldest things they can find, down to and below freezing in Colorado in one case.
Yeah, it makes sense that they would like it where it was warmer to raise their kids.
Yes, although I think they're the only ones that, at least in our part of the world, prefer that high a temperature.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just interesting thinking about, trying to raise your kids in a cave where it's near freezing.
Yeah, I don't think they would do that.
Okay. Yeah, because you need a lot of food just to keep warm yourself, and then you have to keep your kid warm.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And a lot of trouble with that.
The Wallatai Reservation is a fascinating area because the Red Wall Limestone is at or near the surface in a lot of it.
Right.
It has tremendous cave potential, in my opinion. And in the early 70s, some of us, in this case, mostly coming from California, had the opportunity to do some caving and cave surveying before the Indians apparently became more uptight about white trespassing and made it extremely difficult to get permission to do it.
Okay.
I'm not really sure what the situation is today.
Oh, it's still very much closed. Yeah, that's their land and their call, and totally understood. Did you do any other besides Quartermaster and Spencer Marowetica? Any other?
Upper Diamond Creek. By upper, I mean above the Peach. At Peach Springs Wash. Just above Diamond Creek.
Right, and you talked about that. That was one of the first caves we talked about early on.
As it happened, there are ancient Red Wall caves that directly overlook Peach Springs Wash low down in there. And Louise Hoves, who's presently a geologist in Nevada, and some of her personal friends and family established that project of trying to find caves on the Wallatai Reservation. And we found the biggest one that ended up being called Corkscrew Cave. I'm not clear now why we did. It's not that shape exactly, but it was a maze of large passages in which we surveyed 3 miles.
Wow.
We kept it very quiet at the time. I tried not to let word of it out so it wouldn't be overwhelmed.
And this is accessed via Peach Springs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There was a route that we were able to climb out from the bottom to the Red Wall in that particular zone and get up through to the upper Red Wall, and then around the corner, so to speak, to the west, if you go a half mile or so along the Red Wall Rim south, you come to Hindu Canyon, a remnant of ancient river canyon that somehow formed there and supposedly originated actually to the south and west, I think, rather than being from the Grand Canyon proper as it's presently known. But somehow that was forming hypogene caves in the area there. And the Corkscrew was the biggest one we found, but there were several others that were quite respectable in size. days, and some of it had Indian perishable stuff in shelters.
Hmm. What's Louise's last name?
H-O-S-E.
Okay, thank you.
And there was one cave where we found fibrous quids, which the occupants of the rock shelter had spat out after chewing mescal up, apparently.
Ah.
I'd wondered in the past just how did they eat that stuff. It seemed very coarse, even when cooked. So the answer was they spat out what they didn't want to swallow.
Which makes sense. Sure. Sure. And I would assume, difficult to get to, but on the north side, the northwest side of Grand Canyon, meaning across into Burnt Canyon, into Surprise Canyon, into Tin Cannabis Canyon, Salt Canyon, there's a number of canyons on the north side of the river, though, of course, as you point out, the south side has all of the overlaying strata, Kaibab, Toro Weep, Coconino, Hermit, Supai, all eroded away. And on the north side, it's not. They're all still there. But
on the other hand, the general trend of the dip in most parts of the canyon, at least I'm not sure about that one, is from north to south. So the sources would, as a rule, be on the north side.
And there is water in Surprise Canyon. That's probably, I'm trying to think of it, you know, there's a little water in Separation, but not much. But it just seems like there's a lot more water coming from the south into the canyon, into the river. But there is water still coming from the north. Number of springs there, not that big.
I never got to visit Surprise Canyon, unfortunately. The central part of the canyon was where I had my least opportunity to explore, except for the Wildfire Reservation.
Right, and Surprise is just downstream of Spencer and just comes in from the north side. And so I would think there's a ton of caving to be done still over there, unless Louise or anyone else of that Vegas crowd has decided to try to work that area coming in. Off.
Well, those of us who used to do that are all too feeble.
Oh, yeah, but there's the young kids like Jason are out there.
Yes.
So.
And Jason has gone to some quite remote places looking and finding something or other in most of those he visits.
Oh, good for him. Well, that's good. Exploration continues then. That's good.
And fortunately, he has communicated with me and kept me up to date on what he does.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. Very nice.
It's especially nice when it deals with places I'd been that I had unfinished business with, and he can finish the business and tell me what I would have found if I'd done it.
And he can find your penny.
Yes.
And relate who left this penny and why does it say 1967 on it? Or 69.
Yeah. I left a nickel I'm so embarrassed when I can't come out with a word. Anyway, one of the East Rim caves. Name off caves off the East Rim.
Oh my, I'm not that much of a caver. You know, I'm just thinking about the Little Nakweep area or the...
A bit farther south than that and higher in the embayment.
Well, Chiava is there.
Not that far.
Okay, so back a little bit.
Actually back a lot from it.
Oh, okay, so Lavachuar.
Near the neck of the whole plateau.
Oh.
And that's perfectly well-known cave. I was first caver after WSI to get to go there because I went directly to Merrill Club and asked him.
Oh, fun. Wait a minute. You went to Merrill Club. Donald, I tell you what. Let's put a comma in this interview right here. And the next interview, I'm going to ask you about Merrill Club.
I can only tell you a slight amount about him. I just had one visit with him that one time, I think.
Well, we'll pick it up with that. I want to know how you connected up with him and how where you found him and
I found him in Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay. Now, I look forward to hearing about that. Huh. Cool.
Yes, he was the true predecessor of Harvey Bushart.
Indeed. Yes, he was. Indeed. Is there anything else you'd like to bring into this interview that we've covered that I didn't ask you about?
Probably, but it isn't popping up.
Okay. Well, with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Today is Monday, January 30th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Donald, thank you so very much.